The following Dharma encounter with Jeffrey Shug and Arnold Roshi took place at Zen Mountain Monastery at the conclusion to a week-long meditation session. As you'll hear, Dharma encounters begin with the introduction of a topic related to Zen practice and training. Students then volunteer to present their understanding of the topic or a question for the Dharma encounter teacher to reflect on. The presence of fellow students means that anyone in attendance can benefit from the exchange. We hope you enjoy.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to you, those of you who are joining us this morning from home. So this morning we are both concluding our Ango, which began in early March, this twice a year 90-day training period that is a tradition that goes back really to the Buddha. Takes its particular form within our lineage, going back hundreds of years. And we're also concluding Sesshin, this week of intensive practice together. So we're going to do that with this Dharma encounter. Dharma encounter is a meeting between student and teachers, teacher and students, in which I will present a subject that is not yet announced, and you will present questions or comments not yet known. And in that way, it's present and happening right now. And it's a way for the teachings to be conveyed, to take place in the present moment, in public, together as a Sangha, different than Doksan or Daisan, where that happens private and it's confidential, or a Taisho, which is just a talk directed towards the Sangha. Dharma encounter is intended to be more direct pointing, so less sort of conversational and conceptual, although it really depends on the presence of the student and where they are. And what I wanted to bring up this morning is, because we've been studying the Lotus Sutra all Ango, and one of the hallmarks of the Lotus Sutra, which is very important text within the Mahayana tradition, is its use of parables. So there are all of these parables through the sutra that are speaking to expedient means, skillful means, which is a very important theme within the sutra, and Buddha nature, self-nature, which is perfect and complete from the very beginning, which is our nature. And so I thought it would be good to have as our final encounter another parable from the sutra to give us a place to focus our energies and our inquiries. So in this sutra, I'm going to read and paraphrase this at the same time. It says, there is a skilled physician who's wise and understanding and who knows how to compound medicines to effectively cure all kinds of illness. Now, the Buddha is the physician here. The father and the Buddha has sometimes been likened to a physician who, in the Four Noble Truths, identifies the illness, which is dukkha, samsara, our attachments, our false views, and then proceeds to present understanding about the nature of that illness and our prognosis, which is we are all capable of freeing ourselves, and then the path, which you could think of as a treatment. So here the Buddha is this wise physician who has many children, perhaps 10, 20, or even 100, or thousands. And the parent, this physician, goes off to a distant land to take care of some matters, and while he's gone, his children drink some kind of poison that makes them distraught with pain and they fall writhing to the ground. So when the father, the physician, the Buddha comes home, he sees that his children have drunk poison and it says some are completely out of their minds while others are not. But seeing the father from far off, they're overjoyed and they say, come to him and say, how wonderful that you've returned. We were ignorant and by mistake drank this poison. Can you please help us? Can you please cure our illness? And so the father, being a wise physician, puts together a medicine herb that is fragrant in flavor and gives the dose to all of the children and says, this is highly effective. It meets all the requirements necessary. And if you take it quickly, you'll be relieved of your sufferings and will be free of your illness. Says those children who had not lost their senses could see that this was good medicine, outstanding, and so they took it and immediately were cured of their sickness. Those who were out of their minds were equally delighted to see the father return and begged him to cure their sickness, but when they were given the medicine, they refused to take it. Why? Because the poison had penetrated deeply and their minds no longer functioned as before. So although the medicine was excellent in all ways, they could not perceive it as being good. And so the father, the physician, thinks, my poor children, because of this poison, their minds have become befuddled, confused. They're happy to see me, and they ask me to cure them, but they refuse to take the medicine that will heal them. And so he tells them, I'm old and worn out. I'm soon to die. I need to leave for a while and take care of some matters. I'm leaving this medicine here for you to take. It's good, and you should take it. But don't worry if it won't cure you. Just take it anyway. And then having given those instructions, he goes off. And then he sends a messenger back to tell his children that he has died. The children are distraught hearing that his father has left and deserted them. And filled with great grief and consternation, they think to themselves, if our father was alive, he would have pity on us and see that we are protected, would take care of us. But he's abandoned us and died in some other country far away. We're now shelterless orphans with no one to rely upon. And so harboring such feelings of grief, they at last came to their senses and realized that the medicine was in fact excellent. And so they took it and they were healed of all the effects of their poison. So of course the poison in Buddhism is our attachments, our false views, the kleshas, these deep underlying forces, greed, anger, and delusion, pride, and jealousy, these very strong mental and emotional states that we all experience in different degrees. They can flood our system like a poison, cripple our ability to think rationally, empower our more negative emotions, generate very strong desires, and solidify our views. These poisons, to speak of them that way, we actually talk about the three poisons, these sort of dominant kleshas, greed, anger, and delusion, live within a person, they live within each of us, they can live within a group, within an organization, within a website. Sometimes they render us completely out of our mind, it seems. And they cause great suffering. Sometimes we retain some of our senses, using the language of the parable, in which we create some harm, but we then come to our senses and realize what we've done. We take responsibility, and we have many ways of doing that in practice. And some of us have come more to our senses and less act out of that poison state, although the poison is still within us in a deep, underlying, latent sense. And so as practitioners who are practicing or dedicated to coming to our senses, living within the earnest commitments and vows and intentions that we cultivate, we practice strengthening and living, having faith in Buddha nature, and the sense of dignity and respect that that endows each of us worthy of. Living this way makes life naturally more at ease, more clear, more in harmony. Along the way, while those poisons are still present and still exerting their influence within ourselves, within other practitioners, certainly within the world at large, there are flare-ups, right? It's like when you've been sick and you think you're pretty much over it, and then you kind of have a little bit of a relapse. And so there are flare-ups, and sometimes those flare-ups are small and easily addressed, and sometimes they're large and catastrophic. For the bodhisattva, as we are healing ourselves, which means we have to be intimately aware of the nature of the poison as well as the medicine, as well as the consequences, and it was the whole system. What leads to bring that, what causes those poisons to come into our system to become strong? What is it like when we lose our senses? So we actually need to develop awareness and skill when we are out of our senses, which means we are not entirely out of our senses. And to do the same when others are in similar states. And then the consequences of those actions. And to study all of these various states of being out of our mind. And so when we have lost our senses and we're under the sway of these poisons, these kleshas, and we don't want to turn towards that good medicine, it's there, but I don't want to take it, how then to be skillful? When the physician has left the country and left you on your own, right? No longer there to protect you, right? You can't rely on them. You have to rely on yourself. What is the skillful means? When others around us, when their minds no longer function as before, no longer function within Buddha nature, within a clear sense of what is right and what's wrong, what's true and what's not true, when they're moving from those delusions rather than mindfulness and compassion, how do we help them? How do we help them when they're not asking for help? In the same way, how do we ask ourselves when we're not asking for help? When we or someone else perceives the medicine as poison, what is skillful then? When we perceive what is poison as medicine. An old master said, true compassion focuses on the whole infinity of beings as well as on the ultimate condition of phenomena. Thus, compassion has a twofold, all-embracing form. It is both referential and non-referential. And what that means is that true compassion at times focuses directly on the infinity of beings, the actuality of living beings, our suffering, the poisons, our actions, the consequences of those actions, our emotions and thoughts, our beliefs and views. And so we have precepts, we have various ways of understanding the precepts, we have vows, we have intentions, we have session guidelines, we have ango, all of the forms of training to turn towards this, what he calls this referential perspective of compassion. It is what we can see, what we can touch, what we can directly address and shift. And then the non-referential aspect of compassion, which is its ultimate nature, that it has no inherent nature. It doesn't exist as a something in the world, in us. It's not a thing. Love, the great love of the bodhisattva, is very real. It's one of the most powerful forces in the world, but you can't actually locate it anywhere. You couldn't put it on a plate. You couldn't put it on a balance scale and measure it. This person's as heavy and this person's as light. It's non-referential. And this old teacher is saying it has this twofold, all-embracing form. So a question is, how does understanding the relative dharma, relative compassion, help us in trying to heal sickness? How does understanding the ultimate dharma help you? How do these work together? Master Linji said, there's a true person of no rank who moves in and out of their senses. And if we should relate that to the sutra, who moves in and out of being in their senses. And we could look at that and understand that in different ways. But ultimately, they are a true person of no rank. Everyone is such a person Everyone is such a person free of poison, who is actually fully in their senses. And yet we lose our mind now and then. So how do we help ourselves in moments of faith, when we have faith in that, in moments when we have lost that faith? In moments when we readily move towards what is medicine, and in moments when we're actively moving away from it? And how, in a world filled with, in our world, probably mostly people who are not Buddhists, who are not practitioners, for whom this is not a path, how do we live our vows to alleviate suffering, to serve, to be of service, to be of benefit? And further, how do we do that in the company of neighbors, human beings, sentient beings, fellow citizens of this country, of this earth, who are actively ingesting the poison, who are actively moving away from the medicine, and actually have no interest in your Dharma view? What then? And so these are the things that I wanted to explore. So someone is going to come up first. That person, I don't know who they are, but they do. Yunnan, it looks like. And we'll do three bows. And everyone else can do one bow. And what I'd like to do is open this up to those of you who are formally involved in Ango and have not had a chance to do Dharma encounter in the previous two sessions. Okay? So please come up and help us all understand these questions. Yeah, this is when you don't think about it and you just let your legs move. I mean, part of the training, part of our training, this is a way to actually let yourself be of service. You present your practice. I thought it would be good to end Ango with some extremely difficult questions. Lest we think Ango is actually over.
Shosanchi. I notice when I don't want to take the medicine, it's because I'm afraid of feeling the suffering.
You're afraid of?
Feeling the suffering. Mm-hmm. Of myself and of those around me.
But if you're afraid of taking the medicine, does that mean you don't already know that you're suffering? What would give rise to the thought of taking the medicine?
I have this idea that there's a shortcut.
Mm-hmm. So you know that you're suffering, but you think there's a shortcut.
I think I can skim over the top without...
Beat it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how successful has that been?
It never works. Mm-hmm. But I'm a slow learner.
So what is that? You know, we could call ourselves stubborn or thick-headed, but what's really going on when you examine that? Is that the poison or is that the medicine?
That's the medicine.
What did you do with the poison?
The poison is the medicine.
Master Yuman said, medicine and sickness heal each other. The whole world is medicine. Where do you find yourself? May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanchi. I made a commitment to myself before session that I would engage in Dharma encounter, because I never do. But it's really, really hard right now. Because coming out of Sashim, we heard the news about this latest killing, and it's not a great time for that. And I heard that 19 children and two teachers were killed. And, you know, that's absolutely devastating. And that's all that I knew, and Texas. And then when we were doing the service, I heard their names. So I realized that they were killed because they were Hispanic, I guess. I had all these Hispanic names. I don't know if I'm mistaken about that. So it was like another blow in the, you know, the body of this country that we live in. And your question is something that I think about and live with a lot, and it just got completely shattered, you know. I think, oh, the things that happened in my home, or the things that happened with my work people, and how I try to see, you know, Kanzeon, Bodhisattva, realizes all beings are one essence. Mind is one essence. And that's something that feels kind of accessible in a difficult circumstance, like in a challenge at home with my wife or something. And I feel I have a little possibility of skill with that. Mm-hmm. But when I heard this, you know, I just feel rage. Mm-hmm. And so much sadness. And mm-hmm. it's like, it's so overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so in my practice, I think when I settle down a little, I will try to approach it from that perspective.
But before we go there.
What's that?
Before we go to yeah. that. So to be on this path means to face the world that we have, not the one we dream about. And so that means in such moments, small and large, we have to learn how to hold the magnitude of the world in one action, in one moment, right? You have a daughter. And so part of our skill is how to hold what is unbearable. In a sense, how to hold what no person should have to hold. But here it is. And so, you know, for me, this was a wonderful and difficult week because I knew about this early on, and I knew that most of you did not. And so there was the aspect of trying to hold that and be here in this space where we were doing sesshin, where we were in cloister, very deliberately and importantly. And that there would be a time to open that up, but it was not now. And so how to hold that within myself. And so there was anger and despair and pain. And it's not gone. And to think about what are our options there. Because we've already developed certain strategies, so we can just want to get rid of it. Get past it, become numb, suppress it, distract ourselves. Or we can get entangled. And we don't even have to know much details. Like I didn't say very much this morning at all because I didn't want to decide for each of you when and how you were going to find out about this, having just come out of session. And so we don't really need to know so much to know enough. Children being killed, right? And so to hold that, to be able to hold that in our mind and not proliferate, it's like, what is skillful? What is the medicine? The feeling is there, so we have to feel it. To not feel it is to not practice what's in front of us. And to be mindful means we can actually experience that and even be overwhelmed and still not have lost our senses. We know that we're overwhelmed. We are choosing to enter into those emotions, to allow them to flood our system, but we're still aware. That's our capacity. It's our natural capacity. And that may we may slip in and out of that, right? Where we lose our senses and then we become aware of them. I mean, that's why it's a practice. And that all of that is bearing the unbearable. And it's also healing. Moving towards healing, right? Because, you know, at home with these, you know, recognizing those things at home and then something like this can help us actually to keep our own, many of our own personal struggles in a larger perspective, right? And that can be helpful. It doesn't diminish or it doesn't negate the challenges that we have, but it can help them to keep them in perspective. And also in practicing those more accessible situations, like at home, like at work, where we actually have more influence, we have more power, we can actually affect change. That gives us an opportunity to be skillful in a certain way. One of the difficulties about something like this is we don't have that kind of access, right? We can't fix this, and that's unbearable, right? To have to acknowledge that I want this to just stop. And I can't. I don't have that power. And so that's why compassion has no fixed rule. Every situation is different. And so what is the medicine when we need to face it and, in a sense, heal? You know, sometimes there's criticism about, well, how long does the grief and the agony last? A few days? And, you know, that can be a criticism, like we just get numb and go on and then it happens again. But, you know, we have to go on. We have to go on. We can't just get mired. And so what is that, right? How do we keep going, not forget? How do we actually learn? I mean, that's, in a sense, the most agonizing part of this for me, is we don't seem to be learning. Or moreover, we don't seem to want to be learning.
Who's we?
Well, exactly.
I mean, I feel like we know it on this level. But you said, what about when we encounter people mm-hmm. who are not like on our path, not mm-hmm. Buddhist? And of course, there's lots of good people who mm-hmm. will manifest Buddhist values. But I have
millions.
Millions. I have people in my life who share my values generally, mm-hmm. but also value harboring hatred for certain people. Mm-hmm. And that's a place where I try to enter. Like, their love, you know, and of course for myself, I have to enter there because I feel a lot of hatred for people who knowingly create evil.
So that's why we have to come back to ourselves. Right? To see those poisons running through our own veins, to see those moments of hatred, the same things that we see in other people, right? So that it is not them, it's us. And yes, we are different people in different fields of influence. We have different kinds of power. That is definitely true. But in terms of this path and working with compassion and moving it forward, right, it has to start somewhere, right? Within our own senses.
Yeah, and I think for me it has to start with choosing not to indulge my feelings of hatred.
And at the same time, we can't just cut them off. In other words, we have to acknowledge, I feel this, right? That's honest, it's valid, it's true. You don't have to indulge it, right? Feeling it doesn't mean we're indulging it. It can become that, but it doesn't have to. And that's exactly the path that we're cultivating, right? Seeing that moment, that emotion doesn't bind us to any particular path, right? May your life go on.
Thank you for your answer.
Shosanji, when I got online, I really didn't know what was going to come up, and I didn't expect it was going to be this, but here we go. You asked about being in a difficult place and how that was worked with.
That was?
How I worked with that. Mm-hmm. Early in the pandemic, I nearly killed myself in the isolation. I had a noose around my neck. I was testing it for strength to see if I could tie it off somewhere in my house. Obviously, I didn't. I'm not exactly sure what stopped me, But I'm pretty sure that this practice, just at a very deep level, had a lot to do with it.
Do you remember the moment when it shifted? What was happening?
I was standing in the living room. I could feel it. I still feel it here. And I think I just made a decision that I wasn't going to do this anymore. Do this as in consider this a way out. Mm-hmm. Consider it a way out. Mm-hmm. And I think after that I remembered sort of, you know, my son. Mm-hmm. This practice. Mm-hmm. I feel like it would be almost a shame on my practice to take this, mm-hmm. take that kind of shortcut. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, thank you.
Thank you
for that decision. And I ask you that if that ever comes close to you again, that you reach out. I don't know what it was either, but it sounds a lot like life calling, yeah. Like not wanting actually what you wanted in that moment. Like knowing that that actually wasn't going to solve something. You know, to think about in the depths of such a moment, how something rises up from within. What can that be but wisdom, compassion? You didn't ask for it. You didn't decide in that moment, I'm guessing, that you were going to change your mind.
Not that I'm aware of.
Right. And whether that was a result of your practice, very likely. Other people, not practitioners, also have such moments. I've talked to many people in very, very difficult circumstances who themselves said they had no basis for a good choice. They had had created no fertile ground within themselves from which to make a good choice in such a moment. But they did. How wonderful that is. And to continue to trust that and love that part of yourself.
Yeah, that did turn into a commitment. Never to even engage that as an option.
Good. And thank you for testifying to that. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So, Sanji, Buddha nature. Thank you for giving me all of these terms to ponder this term. I don't know if I know what it is, but I've had a good time thinking about it. Also, sometimes I get tired, and I doubt. Mm-hmm. And I think as this term, I have been able to become a little bit more explicit in that search. That doubt has gotten like a little more peaked at times, right? And I've worked with it enough in my life and in my practice to sort of take a step back, you know, get some rest, come back to it the next mm-hmm. day. And I keep doing that.
Mm-hmm. First, I'd like just to notice that in the same way that we can go from Angaku to Jikai to you, and each of these worlds that is brought forward, in one moment this world, in one moment this world. And that as practitioners, that's what we're developing, our capacity to hold within ourselves. That in that beautiful service, thank you for that dedication, and the poem that I don't know what anyone else was feeling. But to feel that, the tragedy, the solemnity, and the joy, the affirmation, all in one moment. And that that's what happens when we don't grasp and we don't get mired, right? And that's really, isn't that our role, is to keep living, right? And so how do we live with death? How do we live with catastrophe? How do we live with Buddha nature? How do we live with endless possibility? How do we live with tiredness? And so, you know, I spoke yesterday in the Teisho that truly we are discovering how powerful we are. We're just people, right? I mean, don't try and turn yourself into a superhero, right? It's not a fantasy. There's too much fantasy, right? We have turned fantasy into, I don't know, a national creed or something. And where does that come from? It comes from our fantasies. That's what we do. We proliferate things that are not real, that do not exist, something that is not happening. And we create that world as our world. And we see how that world can become death, right? And it can become life. And so the Bodhisattva brings to mind an intention, creates something with their mind that is life-affirming, brings forth generosity in the moment when they feel greedy, brings forth energy in the moment when they feel tired, brings forth the desire to live, right, because of a child, because it brings forth getting out of bed when you'd rather stay in it because people are waiting for you in the Zendo. From the very simple to the very profound. And that's what we're in the midst of all the time. And so learning to unstick ourselves and to live with the world, live with life as it's happening, live with this as it's happening. That's why we have to face the moment that is within us, as unsavory as that might be. I don't want to feel a person that is feeling hatred, but I'm feeling hatred. I don't want to be that person who wants to destroy, but God, I want to destroy. And so to not deceive anyone, right, means I cannot deceive myself at that moment. So I have to enter into that and be a midwife, a steward, a guide to that emotion in that moment in a way that is not denying, but is not indulging. And that is a revolution. The Buddha called it the middle way, right? Which can sound very, I don't know, easy. Just stand in the middle, for Christ's sake. It demands constant, wonderful attention and vigilance and joy and aspiration and returning. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanji. I see that when I don't want to take the medicine, it's because I want to read the label first.
You want to?
Read the label first.
What does that mean?
On the bottle.
I know, but yeah. What does that mean to you? What's that an analogy for?
I want to know what's going to happen.
In advance.
In advance. Mm-hmm.
Sorry. So.
I can't read it because it's too dark to read. But if I take the medicine, the light turns on.
Well, you can make something up.
I can make something
right?
up.
You can write your own label. We do that all the time. But to be willing to take that medicine, not knowing what the next step will be, requires what of you?
Trust.
In?
Buddha nature.
Buddha nature in that moment, may be an idea that you have faith in.
Yeah.
It's worthwhile having faith in that,
yeah,
right? Because that's where it has to begin until it becomes more realized. But what else can you have faith in that might be a little more touchable?
I can't touch it, but I can feel it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And have you ever leapt before without that label? Have you ever had that experience?
Mm-hmm.
Remember that. Remember that. Right? In other words, recall that to mind. Mindfulness has the element of remembering, bringing to mind, and that can mean different things within Buddhism, but it means recognizing I have been in a similar moment before. What have I done before, and where did that lead? What else have I done, and where did that lead? You know, the kleshas, our entanglements, our karma, when it gets very confined, part of what it does, it shuts out any view, right? It's just do what seems the only thing to do. And what mindfulness does is it allows you to continue to open the space up in your mind and in your heart and realize and see what's happening and bring to mind what you've learned. Because as a practitioner, you are accumulating extremely important information. You know, it's like if you were in school and every day you went to class and you took notes and then you went home and you studied and studied and studied and then you intentionally forgot all of that, right? And go back to school the next day and start again, right? Like that wouldn't make sense, right? And so you're building upon knowledge. And that's what gives you strength and facility and capacity within that particular field, right? That's developing your skills within that particular part of your life. Well, this is not really that different, you know. But all too often, we're not paying attention. We are paying attention, but then we're not drawing upon that we've really learned. Maybe it's because we think, well, this time it's going to be different, right? This time I'll get what I want. Or this time I'll do this and no one will find out. You know, I can contain this deception. We all have lots of strategies. But to bring to mind, you know, that's part of the Bodhisattva vow, is if it's just about you, if it's just about me, then there will be lots of moments when we'll let ourselves slide. Well, this is good enough, right? I'm okay with this. I'm tired. It's not, you know, I don't... You know?
Yeah, like sitting on the line, I was like, okay, well, that's the answer. Now I can stop practicing and I'll just wait until it's my turn to go up. keep going.
But when others are counting on us, like you're going to get up here and everybody's going to be listening,
yeah,
right? That then it draws from us that larger heart, that larger responsibility. We have a mutual responsibility. We are affecting each other for God's sake. Right? And so that can call us forward, call us in ways that can be so much more powerful than when we're just in our own isolated sphere. And so that's where that sense of mutual responsibility is a tremendous force of good, right? And so let's use that, huh? May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So, Sanchi, this enormous stone house, this medicine, this sickness, this weight and power rests on the wings of a dandelion seed that just happened to land on an unfurling fern frond.
Can you sort of flesh that out a little bit for those who might not have understood?
Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm. And what about it?
It's unfurling. And becoming through this form.
Mm-hmm. You know, from traditional Buddhist teaching all the way back to the Buddha, you know, we live an infinite number of lifetimes. And that in those lifetimes, we have lived in all possible ways. We've lived very, very badly. And we've lived well. And that we are within that ongoing cycle of lives and deaths, we are moving forward because fundamentally we have this impulse away from pain and towards pleasure, away from death and towards life, away from hatred and towards compassion. It's a basic fundamental impulse. But because of the conditions, causes, because of many, many factors, we live this particular life in certain ways, right? And so, which is preparing the next life. And so when we see an action, a person with guns killing children, right? From a Buddhist perspective, that life is going to bring unimaginable pain and suffering to the consciousness of that person in their successive lives. We know that it brings that to the family of humanity, anyone who's paying attention, anyone who is alive. And so if we look at it from that perspective, there has been a lifetime where I was that person, right? Where I died all kinds of deaths. I might have caused all kinds of deaths. Now that's a way of looking at it from traditional Buddhism, which not everyone has faith in. But if we think about, if we take that and put that sort of scheme, that paradigm into one lifetime, right, and change the scale a little bit, because most of us work within a narrower range of actions, right, can we see the ways in which we have acted out those different impulses? We have indulged, we have lost our senses in different ways. And as practitioners, can that both open our hearts? Can it help us to cultivate compassion towards ourselves and others? Can it also make us wise about the conditions that bring those particular states forward? Right effort is when those conditions arise and seeing how unhealthy, unskillful, how destructive they are, we are vigilant. We are urgently working towards calming and diminishing those. We're not lazy about it because we realize the potential that those have. And then we're also even more are vigilant about the conditions that might bring those forward. And so we're trying to create in our personal and larger lives conditions that don't, you know, if this was an isolated act, it would be horrible enough. But the fact that it is not an isolated act means it's a part of a larger system in which this action is actually fulfilling certain conditions that continue to be created. So what are those many conditions, right? And so, and then we too are our own complex system. But so Buddhism is giving us really profound ways, not answers, not solutions, but ways in to examine the inner workings so that we can, within ourselves, be cultivating the working to diminish those conditions which are not skillful and bringing forth and strengthening those conditions which are. And that means within our body and mind, and it means out here. I mean, that's what this is. It doesn't get, in a sense, it doesn't get any easier than this for a Buddhist. And that point of it, and that's intentional. And it's we know this is not the rest of the world, right? There are no illusions here. We're not pretending that this is preparing us for every situation. It's not. It's containing, in a sense, those ranges of dukkha so that as we are finding our legs, right, discovering, it's like we're, you know, we're toddling, all of it, drooling, you know, shitting in our pants, you know, all of it. That we're able to work within, in a sense, manageable ranges of suffering and humanity, right? Because the principles that we are developing are basically the same. So that then we can go forward and contemplate and face and try to our best, imperfectly though it will be, practice meeting the world that is so much larger and complicated. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching. Shosanchi, I feel great joy in being here and seeing you here. And I want to ask about grief, complicated grief, grief that can bring you to your senses or can mire you. Mm-hmm. And I want to just name the people lost in Buffalo, mm-hmm. Which brought me to grief mm-hmm. again, and a recognition that that grief of my country mm-hmm. and the racial crimes mm-hmm. And the hatred that exists and the violence. When I began to recognize that in our country, and I was on an academic career, and I began to see the depths of the violence in the last 100 years since slavery ended, the depths of the attempted erasure of the massacre in Oklahoma, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and to recognize every time there's a crime like this, that I hold it. And at that time, 10 years before I came to practice, I was feeling that grief. And I shut down. Mm-hmm. And yet, something was moving me forward. Mm-hmm. Something was bringing me here.
Right into it.
Right into it.
Yeah.
And I wonder, my question is, when that grief comes up, I think it is... I recognize that many switch into despair mm-hmm. and like I did, shut down and mm-hmm. deflect and move away from. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that. Mm-hmm. I know that experience, you know, and how easily it shifts from just a feeling of grief, of heartbreak, right, of senselessness, of needlessness, so unnecessary. And then how quickly that slips, particularly as the mind, and that's to really watch what's happening. What are we thinking? You know, as the mind begins to extrapolate, to move outward, you know, how it can move into hopelessness, into despair, into cynicism. And so, but mindfulness allows us to recognize that. You see yourself sliding, right? And you know, when I was experiencing that earlier in the week, and I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to have to talk about this. I'm going to have to hold this somehow. I'm going to have to not just present despair, right? But it's here, right? I don't want to present hopelessness. Sorry, it's hopeless. It doesn't actually work. This doesn't work, right? Right. That's not going to fly, right? It's also, I know that is not true.
Because that medicine works.
Yes, but in that moment, there's slipping,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I slip, I go, because I need to go through that grief. I need to go through that experience to not indulge it. I need to go into it to not indulge it, but I need to go into it knowingly. Right? And all of you help me to do that because I know I need to be accountable for whatever I do, for whatever I say. It matters. And what do I want to be? How do I want to, what effect do I want to have? But I have to get there honestly. Right? And it doesn't mean that I have to leave all the grief behind. I've been carrying it all week.
Right. Well, that's one of the things that I feel strongly is that we don't talk about it in our world enough. Mm. We don't acknowledge it enough. We don't accept it from each other.
So we can start here.
Yeah.
May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching. So, Tanji, I grew up in a home that was filled with violence and abuse and a lot of pain, poverty, a lot of pain. Fantasy was my escape. Mm. I call myself educated by Disney and Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Did it help you?
For a time.
Yes.
It did.
Can we just acknowledge that?
Yes. It gave me some respite.
Yeah.
It gave me some way to remove myself in my mind when my body had to stay present.
Right, because what else could you do?
There was nothing else available.
Right.
So, so I became a science fiction fan for a long time. And I discovered that it's not real. And much of what I read and watched in that genre was filled with some sort of potential, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. for a new kind of human being. Mm-hmm. A better kind of human being, a different kind of human being. And I knew I couldn't be those things. I was just this kind of human being. So.
Little did you know.
Right? So the core question for me became, what's true and what's real? When I am in my pain, I don't want to be in my pain. I don't like my pain.
Right.
I want it to go away.
Right.
And I've learned a lot of who, believe it or not, I was a very shy, quiet child. I know it's hard to believe. Recognizing that I am not my pain. That I am not it, and that it requires so much energy to perpetuate, and that there has to be something better, there had to be something better,
right.
somehow landed me here in 1994 on a journey of discovery. And now I have tools. I have a toolkit.
Yeah.
And so when I find pain and meet it and see it, I feel it, and I spend some time suffering, and then I ask myself, what does it have to teach me? And the only way I can listen is to sit down and be quiet and let it in, and something good, something positive arises from that.
Mm-hmm.
And with regard to other people, you know, that's hard, right? That's the world I'm in. Other people, they don't care about me being a Buddhist, they don't, right? And the only thing I can find that I can do, I'm only responsible for myself. I cannot change other people. I'd like to, but I can't. So so I work to see their humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to meet that with love.
Yeah, and the thing is, I know what you mean by you can't change people, and that's true, but you are changing them all the time. It's just the way it is. And we are all actually doing that. The question is just how, in what direction, towards what world. And so, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge with how you began that, you know, the history of violence in our country, in our world, is pretty old. So what we are actually trying to do is mammoth from that perspective, to actually try and change a path that has been there from the beginning. Not everywhere, always, in everyone, but as a way of being in the world, a way of resolving conflicts. You know, there's a long history. Years ago in New Zealand, I gave a talk because I had read about an island off the coast down in the South Pacific. I don't remember where it actually was, where there was a group of people, indigenous people, who had a completely peaceful existence. They had no word for war. They had no weapons. And I held it up and I said, look, see? And after, you know, that's in us. We can do that. And afterwards, somebody came up and said, do you know what happened to them? Right. But, right, they gave it a shot. And that's kind of what we're doing, right? We're giving it a shot. Because really, what is the alternative? To choose to be out of our senses? To choose to turn against what is true? To not be that person that you actually are, that is so much better than those fantasy characters you were reading about? And so, you know, in Buddhism where it talks about it, there's a point at which it becomes irreversible. We can't go back. It's like you know too much. It's ruined, right? Samsara is ruined.
Good riddance.
Well, yeah, but it's like, oh, if only I could, you know, but no, it's kind of ruined. So thank goodness for that. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Maybe that's what we're doing. We're in the business of ruining samsara. You know, mind is such a delightful thing. I was just sitting here preparing to say some closing words, and you know what came to mind was a story Dada Roshi told years ago of he was coming over during a session to do Dokusan. He was coming in the back door and he saw somebody leaving session with their bags packed. You know, it was middle of the week. And he said, leaving so soon? And he said, yeah. He said, you guys are serious. Yeah, sort of. You know, I think the thing I wanted to end with was just this understanding of how we are always, in every moment, experiencing the moment that has come to us and is being created anew out of actions and the conditions, internally and externally. And to really just examine, understand what Buddhism is talking about when it speaks of this. You know, it's sort of the one of the most profound and brilliant aspects of the Buddha's enlightenment that is presented in all different kinds of ways. But in a basic sense, what it's telling us is that every situation makes sense. That when somebody picks up a gun, or in a nation picks up guns, or when we don't, that in that moment, that action is logical, right? Has a basis that is not just arising in that moment, but has been cultivated, has been engineered, has been developed, has been had faith in, has been repeated over and over again. And that's both the in a sense, the monkey on our back, because it's why it is so hard to change. And why it's so easy to go the same way. But it's also the direct access into change. Because when those conditions are even just slightly different, you know, when I said to Jikai, please, if you ever start feeling like your life is not worthy, of being to reach out, to actually just, because so many times I've reached out to somebody, a student that I haven't seen in a while, how are you doing, what's up, we'll have a simple conversation, maybe very light, and they will later contact me and say, you know, I was in a very difficult place, in a very dark place, we didn't even talk about it, but something about just reaching out, sometimes it takes so much less than we expect to just bring a light, enough light in to see things a little bit differently. And that in the way, and that as practitioners, in a way, over time it takes less and less. Those shifts become easier and easier. We have so much more to rely upon, so many ways in which we can reach out and in. But the same thing is true of other people. And it is, you know, to not be naive, you know, that there is evil in the world. There is evil acting out of people, right? What we call evil, which is such a strong force and word. And there are people who are bent on destruction, who believe in destruction, and see that as life. But they have the same stuff we do. They have the same consciousness. They have Buddha nature. They are also acting out of cause and conditions. That makes sense to them. And that means that everything is still in motion. Everything is in motion. Nothing is fixed. And we don't know how this is going to work out, right? When we take the medicine, we don't know how any of this is going to work out. You know, Jacinda Ardern, I think the Prime Minister of New Zealand, gave a commencement service to a talk at Harvard, and somebody sent me, and I was listening to it a little bit. And she was talking about democracy, and she said, you know, we often sort of grade democracy by how long it's been in existence. But it's kind of like saying, oh, you've been married 50 years, it must be an incredible marriage. Not necessarily, right? She said, it's not just a matter of longevity, it's a matter of thriving, of actually being married, being in love, living relationship, of living democracy, of living Buddha Dharma. In the same way, we could say, oh, I've been practicing 20 or 30 years. That may mean something very significant. It may not. And so to just sort of let all of this inform us, you know, that there are things within our field that we can actually, we do have some measure of a control over, we can actually affect change and see it. And there are things that we just don't have that kind of direct access to. But we are still part of this system of conditions. We are still here. We have voices. We have influence. And within our lives, right? Each of you is going back to somebody, somebody's, and to your various responsibilities. You're going to impact. You're going to mingle. You're going to have conversations. You're going to do stuff. And so we can paralyze ourselves by thinking, I can't fix this. And that's true. And so, and that's not a, it's not a realistic thought. It's not a beneficial thought. But the question of, what is this? What can I do? What am I doing? You already are when you ask that question. And so, you know, there have been so many times where I wish, not really, but for the sake of what I want to say, that Buddhism would just tell me what to do. I never actually wanted it to, but let's just say, right? Because that seems like an easy out. But it doesn't. And it is so good that it doesn't. Of course, it can't, but we have to find our way. And so this is what finding our way looks like. And in the midst of all kinds of glory and beauty and the wonders of humanity in the world, and in all of the horrors that we create, this is what finding our way looks like. And so may we please continue to care about this world, to not, to have that fearlessness of the Bodhisattva is not defeated by how large, how difficult, how long. Right? We have this chance, this lifetime, to bring some measure of wisdom, of compassion, of good into the world. So let us each do what we can. And you already don't know what that is. An excellent place to begin. Thank you for the Sangha. Thank you for your practice. And may we bring all that we can into our beloved and beleaguered world.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.